You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
The EU tries to evade being squeezed between the US and China. The search continues for New Yorkers willing to spend weeks with Donald Trump, and is a comeuppance looming for anonymous online reviews? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Latika Burke and Vincent McAvaney will discuss the day's big stories. We'll have an update from Monocle's team at Salone del Mobile, and this week's letter from is a letter from Thailand. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Latika Burke, journalist and geopolitics specialist, and by Vincent McAvaney, journalist and Monocle Radio regular politics commentator. Hello to you both.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Traditionally, we talk about where the guests have just been, or at least I ask the guests where they've just been. Latika, I don't need to ask you where you've just been because I was there as well.
Doesn't sound at all stalkery.
I hadn't followed you there. In fact, technically, you arrived after me.
Technically.
Yes.
We did have a wonderful time back in Delphi. Second time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you consult the Oracle a second time, Andrew?
We did consult the Oracle a second time.
I did not consult the Oracle, but I did go for a very long walk after the conference finished through the top of the mountains, and it was absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I've been there twice. This is the Delphi Economic Forum, and I keep seeing new bits of landscape that I think it would be nice to walk along one day. So I'm going to go back next year. Vincent, you are going to Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. I'm off tomorrow to Mexico, and I'll be doing a letter from Mexico, possibly on how it is recovering from the pandemic in terms of tourism, some of the changes that have happened to the city, but also the fact that it's still, unlike pretty much everywhere in Europe these days, is still pretty cash dependent, it seems.
Why did you pick on Mexico? Is it somewhere you've always wanted to go?
I do like South America. I like Aztec and history and that kind of thing, but I mean, wanted to get away somewhere far, sunny, seemed like an interesting place.
You are giving up on this British spring, right?
Pretty much. I mean, we're getting all elements of weather in single days at the moment here in London. It's definitely
except none of them are warm.
Yeah, it's not feeling like a, you know, trailer for summer.
Well, we will have more from both of you shortly, but first to Croatia, where the people have spoken and the winners of yesterday's election are now attempting to interpret exactly what they said. The previously ruling Croatian Democratic Union, or HDZ, finished first, but by less than they would have preferred, putting on the table a number of coalition options, both including and not including the HDZ. I'm joined from Ljubljana, from the country next door, that is, with the latest by Monocle's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. Guy, at the very least, the HDZ would appear to have had their wings clipped. Any particular reason why?
Well, the main reasons which are cutting through, the main issues that were cutting through in terms of the anti-HDZ vote were corruption, inflation and young people leaving the country, all of which you could say were connected. But you've got, as President Zoran Milanovic was saying today, and he's no friend of the HDZ, as you probably know, he was saying that, well, two-thirds of the country voted against the HDZ. And that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's something in that. If you've got a party which is the natural party of government in a country, but one which has got an issue in that in the past the party itself has been convicted of corruption, it had a prime minister who served jail time for committing corruption while in office, and it has this image that it runs something of a clientelist operation, that you have to be connected with the HDZ if you want to get on in certain spheres in life. That's problematic for a lot of people in Croatia, and they don't feel too good about it. So if you want to vote against that sort of thing, you would vote for someone other than the HDZ.
Guy, you invoke there the rumbustious, if not downright rambunctious, figure of President Milanovic. He has played a debatably constitutional role in this election. Is there a widespread opinion that he has had his thumb on the scales to an untoward degree?
I don't know if he's had his thumb on the scales in terms of how things have worked out with the election. What he did during the election campaign was probably fairly unconstitutional, because, as you point out, the Constitutional Court banned him from standing as a candidate for Prime Minister, and that would have been for the coalition led by the centre-left SDP. And he said that was a rotten thing for them to do, call them peasants, and then went around the country campaigning, but not campaigning. You know, he wasn't officially a part of the election campaign, but he was saying rude things about the HDZ at every turn, which would then be put to members of the HDZ, including Prime Minister Andrei Plenkovich, and they would then have to respond to Mr. Milanovic's comments, and thus this campaigning but not campaigning worked quite nicely. What it appears to have done is maybe three different things. One, produced a much bigger turnout, one of the biggest turnouts that we've seen in the history of Croatia's elections. Not the largest ever, but one of the biggest. Secondly, it seems to have improved matters for the SDP. Before Mr. Milanovic became involved in their campaign, they were polling at around 13% and looking at getting 20-odd seats in the parliament. They've got 42, which isn't much more than they got last time round, but it's a lot better than they would have got if perhaps Mr. Milanovic hadn't got involved. But the other theory that's flying round is that Mr. Milanovic got everyone out. And he is a bit of a Marmite, or should I say to you, Andrew, Vegemite figure. He is not everybody's cup of meat. And people who don't want a Milanovic-led government, because that was what he was threatening would happen, also turned out and perhaps made sure that they voted for parties that they thought would prevent Milanovic from becoming the head of the next government.
So, Guy, as briefly as possible, which I know is always a dreadful phrase to invoke whenever Balkan politics are involved, what does look like the likeliest governing coalition to come out of this?
It is a big mess at the moment. The HDZ will probably have to eat, or at least Andrei Plenkovic may have to eat humble pie, and get in bed with the Homeland Movement, the right-wing nationalists of whom he has said very rude things in the not-so-distant past. His job may indeed be on the line because of this. On the other hand, the other possibility that's floating around at the moment is a minority government, which would have Mr. Milanovic, the president, who is now the president, as prime minister, and that would be supported by a lot of parties who wouldn't get into a formal coalition together. So it would basically be an anti-HDZ government with very little ideological common ground, apart from the fact that none of those parties are the HDZ.
Guy Delaunay, thank you. Let's bring in our panel with a couple of wider perspectives on this. Vincent, it does look as if somebody in Croatia may face that recurrent conundrum of do we cooperate with unsavoury dingbats in order to be able to put a government together, or do we not? Has anybody actually figured out what the wise move is there? Do you just say, no, we will not deal with these people, they are beyond the pale, or do you try and persuade the electorate and possibly yourself that by bringing them into government you will somehow neutralize them?
Well, that is the key question. I mean, there are arguments for both sides. If you decide, no, we're going to not bring them in because they are too extreme, and you sort of take that stand, then it's likely that, you know, you will face another election again in a short time. And it's whether or not you take the punishment from the voters for forcing them to have to go through another election and go to the polls again, or whether or not you think that you can kind of use the time and the trajectory to get an outright majority. I think sometimes it does help, though, to form a coalition, because you can more easily expose that party. You know, when you had coalition here in the UK, both sides actually tended to like it. It was the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, actually not that far apart in reality, but they both kept, let's say, the lunatic fringes of their own party in check. And if you listen to what David Cameron says now, and George Osborne says now, and Nick Clegg, I mean, the vast majority of people in any country are sort of centrist, and it keeps the government in a very central position. It might not be that progressive, but when you have these coalitions where you've got a sort of more centrist party and a more extreme party, what you do tend to find is you can be the responsible adult in the room. They can be the ones that are performative but can't actually usually deliver in government, because they're sort of not sort of, you know, the same quality of people, and they'd sort of get hung up in the bureaucracy. And so it then exposes them via sort of, you know, disinfectant of sunlight as not being a good force in politics. And then when you either your coalition collapses or you manage to make it to the next election, you can point to the evidence and say, look, we tried to do lots of good stuff in government. They held us back. They couldn't deliver on what they said. We've got a program that we'll now enact if you bring us in, and we've got the experience to do it. So it depends how extreme the party is.
Latika, President Milanovic as well, if he does manage to play a part in the next government of Croatia, has recently been positioning himself as something of a Ukraine skeptic. Would it make any crucial difference to anything if Croatia tilted into the non-pro-Ukraine camp?
I think it would, Andrew, because we're seeing a few of these operatives now. You have Slovakia, you of course have Hungary, you have Austria sitting out there, and now potentially Croatia. I do think that's a worrying mini block forming inside the EU. So, yes, I think it is of huge concern. Also, in the lead up to the European elections, this is going to be a very big question about whether you deal with these far right parties. And Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, will be having to assess this very question about whether she looks for votes in some of those parties at the expense of perhaps her own EPP party to get back in as a second for a second term. So, yeah, I think it is concerning. The other thing I would add to your first question is there's a very good example, however, of where dealing with far-right figures that were once ostracised does become normalised over time. And the example I'm thinking of is Pauline Hanson, who is an Australian politician who about 20 years ago stormed onto the political scene for several reasons. One was because she wanted to anti-Asianise Australia. The second was because she didn't understand what xenophobic meant, having held those policies. And the third was because famously, when asked if she was xenophobic, said, please explain, and this became a national kind of catch cry. Now, fast forward, Pauline Hanson is back in Parliament, and she, during first kind of cobbled together coalition government, had to deal with in the Senate, was very much like, we will never talk to this woman, we do not deal with her. Now she is absolutely pivotal to any sort of negotiations that take place to get legislation through the upper house in Australia. So there is, I think, a lot of precedent for sometimes these far-right figures that people get into a bit of a fluster about the first time they arrive on the scene, eventually becoming someone they do end up doing business with.
Similar, of course, with Nigel Farage, with the Conservatives absolutely desperate to bring him into their party because he seems to have had a bit of a rift with the sort of reform people that he was in, because they think he, you know, might be a slight saviour in this election. But, you know, that idea when David Cameron said absolutely, you know, he'd never be in the party, so now whether, you know, he could come in and take a high position in the party, having crippled them for much of the past decade, is pretty, as you say, you just sort of get used and worn down by this idea.
And in Europe, I think there's a good example here about Giorgia Meloni. When she came onto the scene, everybody said she was far right. Is she that far right? Or is she a G7 leader holding the G7 this year that people will look at by the end of December and say, maybe she's not as radical as we thought?
Well, on that heartwarming thought, we will go now to Brussels, where EU leaders have been gathering to contemplate what might be thought of as their competitive disadvantage, i.e. that the EU is 27 countries which all have to agree on stuff, whereas its two principal rivals, i.e. the United States and China, are only one country each, and one of those does not have to trouble itself over much with the tiresome hurly-burly of the democratic process. Former Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta, concerned that the EU's green tech sector in particular will be crushed, is pitching a proposal for an EU-wide programme of subsidies akin to US President Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and China's extravagant propping up of its own electric car and solar panel industries. Vincent, is the EU right to be worried about all this? Mario Draghi, another Italian contributor to these deliberations, the former ECB president, has also been complaining that US and China are no longer playing by rules, by which I assume he means our rules.
I think there is grounds to be concerned in terms of growth in Europe. Firstly, I'd say, though, if I was going to be a consumer in any of these countries and a citizen, I would rather be in the EU, because those rules are in place to help protectors. You don't get, as we've seen in recent years in China, lead and other chemicals in baby formula and other, you know, dodgy electrics which spark fires. You know, in the United States, utility companies that, you know, pollute and allow water sources to come into, you know, and the chemicals that have been getting into foods there. If you're in the EU, you are pretty much the safest consumer anywhere in the world. Now, obviously, that comes with a lot of bureaucracy and challenges, but companies want to be in this market. It's one of the biggest markets in the world. But it does mean that the EU then sort of sets the standards where, you know, as we've seen with Brexit, lots of companies will say, well, no, we're not going to do specific products or, you know, reduced UK standards. We'll just follow the EU standards, which you no longer get to have a say in, and then we'll put the product in your market so it might be higher than your standards. But in terms of growth, I think there are worries. I mean, this pivot away now, and, you know, Joe Biden perhaps has recognized it quicker than EU leadership has, that, you know, in the face of China's competition flooding the market, particularly, as you mentioned, with EV vehicles from the likes of NIO and BYD, it was interesting, you know, Olaf Scholz went to China this past week as he's trying to de-risk, but as he's trying to maintain links, but as his car companies are crying out that they are panicked about a flood of vehicles coming from China, which take the charge. You know, whilst everyone's dithering about EV vehicles a little bit and the range anxiety and the infrastructure to support them, China knows this is going to be the future, and so they're becoming a dominant player. And there are also security risks with those vehicles because of the way that the cameras work and the sensors work about them being, you know, gathering up huge amounts of data, and where does that data go? So it is a bit of a conundrum for the EU. It does protect its citizens and consumers well, and that stops, you know, problems in health systems and stops, you know, arduous legal issues that you get in the US with these giant class actions with companies. But at the same time, it does mean that things move a little bit slower here, and companies are sort of more wary sometimes of coming into this market.
Well, Latika, as Vincent points out, while EU consumers may be the world's safest, they are certainly not the world's richest. Extraordinary statistic from Letters report: between 1993 and 2022, GDP per capita in the United States grew 60% versus 30% in the EU. Is that related to the fact that it is this consensual collegiate decision-making process, and you do need to get 27 countries, many of whom, frankly, cannot stand each other, all to agree on the same thing at the same time?
I think that's only part of the story, Andrew. I think what we are seeing here is somewhat of an admission that one of the central tenets of the European Union is heading for defeat. And also with that is the concept of globalization. As children of globalization, we thought that we would grow up in an economic system that would project itself, its rules, its values, and some of those regulatory issues that Vincent referred to onto the rest of the world, and gradually lift the standards of developing countries as they came into the developed world. That hasn't happened. And in fact, what we are actually seeing is Chinese economic systems projecting back onto us, because now we are seeing what were capitalist markets, what were governments and parties that were very proudly either libertarian, free trade or centre-right, rushing to protect and subsidise and shore up and potentially even friendshore industries, all because they know China's heavily subsidised, unregulated, unscrupulous economy will not leave them in a position where they can compete. So in many ways, Europe is grudgingly accepting a reality. I think the UK is one of the last at this table. Australia has just, for example, announced a huge protectionist policy to ideally start its own solar and green tech industries. Good luck. But really, we are talking about three major players in this field. It's going to be China, it's going to be the US, and it's going to be the EU. The happy position would be, of course, if the IRA and an EU-style IRA could link up. But under a Trump administration, I don't think we'll get that. Mind you, I'm not even sure even a Biden administration is that much friendlier towards the EU and on those terms. But I do think very much the reverse has happened. Europe's desire to project its regulatory standards on the world is coming to an end.
Just a final thought on this one, Vincent. Clearly, what is underpinning this meeting today is that new thinking is required and new models are required, and they are required sooner rather than later because this race is already proceeding apace. But we have seen in the last 2 years Europe restructure its economy with extraordinary speed by unplugging itself substantially from Russian energy. And I'm not saying that that was an entirely glitch or bump-free endeavour, but I think, well, the sense I get is that Europe found that a lot easier than people thought they were going to when it was initially realised we're going to have to do this. Should the EU take an amount of encouragement from that, realise that it can actually turn on a dime if it has to?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, we're all journalists in this room, and it's probably because we only work well to deadlines, and when needs must, you just get on with it. And it does, you know, you recognise that, okay, there's this problem. We can, if we invest heavily now, it'll pay back over the long term to generate these new industries in power and find new alternatives. I think it does give some confidence, particularly when, you know, talking about de-risking the pandemic and now what is happening with, you know, attacks in the Red Sea and worries about China and potentially invasion of Taiwan and what that would do to superconductors, which, you know, all modern technology relies on, is probably the bigger challenge, because it's about pivoting all of that, you know, manufacturing away from what we've all become so used to and what we thought would all continue, where goods continue to flow, you know, freely and cheaply from the East because it's in their economic benefit. Now that isn't the scenario anymore. So it's about repivoting this. But, you know, what is interesting is in Europe, I'd say there has always been in the continent, particularly in nations like France, a strong feeling against globalization. In some ways, this is what citizens in these countries have always wanted, because it just doesn't seem like it was working for everyone.
I'm less optimistic about that example you give, Andrew, because actually what Europe has done is found a different country to depend upon, and that's mainly gas from America and the Middle East, particularly Qatar. What would be true strategic autonomy, to use a Macronism, is if it were able to come up with its own energy supply. And you look at a country like Germany, which shut down its nuclear, and you don't see good decisions being made here. Now, maybe they can unlock something like green hydrogen and become a real force and have its own energy security. But for the moment, yes, they have taken out Russian dependence, but they're still dependent.
Well, to New York City, where the process of empaneling a jury of Donald Trump's peers is proving tricky. Dozens of potential jurors have already been dismissed after asserting that they, like one suspects, a hefty plurality of their fellow citizens, had long since made up their minds about the former president. And one juror who had been seated has also now been excused after she explained to the judge that her friends and family had discovered she was a juror and that details of where she lived had already been reported by the media, as a consequence of which she said she feared her impartiality had deserted her. Vincent, first of all, protecting the jurors in this trial and his others is going to be a thing, isn't it?
Massively. And they've already changed the procedures for how they're doing this, because some of the reporting, they weren't able to report the names of the people that had been selected, but they reported details such as what they did and where they worked and where they were from in New York. And that has led this morning to the first of two jurors today having to come off this jury. She said that members of her family and friends had already identified her as being one of the jurors and that she didn't feel safe anymore. So this is a huge problem. I mean, what we have in America, which I think is very alien to many, is that, and potentially what we've seen now with the second juror coming off as well, is that they have a massive industry in jury selection. So both sides in this will have these teams poring over all the information they can get on these potential jurors, potentially, you know, their family and friends as well. These people's, you know, that information, if it potentially leaks, particularly, say, from the Trump side, if they become suspicious about a juror, could put that person under real threat, because we have seen in other cases, similarly, when it comes to January 6th, the people that attacked the Capitol, and with Trump's other trials, that members of the judges' families have been information's been put out on them. It's been shared on social media. They have been harassed and attacked, some of them as well. So I think it's incredibly dangerous to be a juror on this case, and you have to wonder. I mean, the level of I wouldn't be surprised at some point if this jury has to be sequestered, because I think the level of threat that they could come under, you know, you see the likes of Carrie Lake, who's running in Arizona and is a close Trump ally. You know, she's been telling people to, you know, get ready for the election by basically arming up. And if that is the mood, I think you'd be pretty brave to say, yes, fine, I'll be a juror on this case.
Well, which prompts the question, Latika, were you summoned? And I realise there's probable legal impediments to that. But nevertheless, if they realise that there's not a single 12-strong panel of available American citizens and resorted to empanelling Australians and they called you, would you sit on this jury?
I would, but they'd probably go through all my tweets and say, no, there's a disqualifying one here or there. It feels a bit like, did you ever read The Last Juror by John Grisham? It feels like one of those John Grisham novels where the court case is such a sensational ripper of a mystery that it's no way as something it could be real life. But seriously, I do really wonder how you could find a jury in the United States that doesn't have an opinion on Donald Trump already. Now, I think that is separate to whether you can form an unbiased opinion about whether he broke the law in this instance, which is what a jury is selected to do. But I honestly do wonder if, you know, the best jury in this case would be a remote camp in Greenland.
But then he did try to buy Greenland, well, you know, so they might, they've got skin in the game.
Because, Vincent, look, I mean, realistically, the best they can hope for is surely 12 people who they are convinced can be relied upon to just assess the facts of the case against the law of the land. Because he is very arguably the most famous human being alive, never mind the best known man in the United States. As Latika says, unless I think you went ploughing up right into the depths of the hollers of Kentucky and West Virginia trying to find 12 people who'd never even seen television. And I think
that could be possible in America.
It could be possible,
be honest.
But I can imagine putting those 12 people on a jury might cause more problems than it solves, especially if they all bring their banjos. But that is the best that can be hoped for here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you've got to find some, you know, rural Luddite who didn't know who the president was for 4 years and think that this person has good judgment, it's kind of beyond the pale. I think it's interesting. I've covered court cases and in a previous life did a lot of work in courts when I was trained to be a lawyer. And, you know, jurors do, when they get on juries, tend to, you know, realise the weight of what is going on. I think it helps them that it's not going to be televised. Mm-hmm. But there are real questions about how juries operate. There was a absolutely fascinating experiment here recently in the UK that Channel 4 did, which I thought was some of the best public service broadcasting I've seen in a long time. Jury research of any form is completely illegal in the UK. Juries don't have to give reasonings at all. There is no training for jurors. And they recreated, word for word, with actors, a recent court case involving a killing and whether or not it should be manslaughter or murder using the provocation defence. What the jury didn't know was that there were actually two juries. They were sitting in these special boxes side by side, listening to the same evidence, hearing the same things, and then you got to watch their deliberations afterwards. It was shocking. And they had people that have been senior prosecutors here in the UK, barristers, legal experts, watching this and reacting to what they were doing. The juries came to completely separate verdicts. And the deliberations were
scary.
Fascinating because what you saw was a lot of people's prejudice coming in. And also, having actually, interestingly, I did a research master's on the defence that they were using, provocation, and they completely and repeatedly got the law wrong in their discussions. Even though it had been explained to them several times, they did get the law wrong multiple times in their deliberations. So, I mean, there is no such thing as the perfect juror. I'm tickled by some of the details that are coming out. Apparently, the foreman is some guy who was born in Ireland but raised in Hell's Kitchen. He's got a flip phone, and in his answers, he says he likes reading the New York Times, but the Mail online too. So he's some sort of, you know, is this the middle of the, you know, is this the ultimate middle of the road person that we need? Who knows? It's going to be incredible for these people because there are as well pressures in the US that you don't get. I remember watching and being stunned a long time ago that the Michael Jackson jury back in his trial in the 2000s, you know, all of them went out afterwards and were doing TV interviews and, you know, have popped up in documentaries and done all that kind of stuff, that you can get this second life in America as well as a, you know, professional juror in big cases.
Well, to Japan and to the kind of legal action liable to cause sleepless nights to those of us who have ever laboured in the critical sphere, lest we find ourselves sued for destroying the career of some hapless indie rock group circa 1994. I'm sure they had it coming. A bunch of Japanese doctors and medical corporations have instructed their learned friends to go after Google, claiming that their businesses have been impaired by disobliging reviews of their services posted on Google Maps. Doctors are at an arguably unique disadvantage, being prevented by medical confidentiality by retorting online to the effect that the disgruntled patient is a malcontent and or a moonbat. Latika, do they have a case? Should the platforms be held ethically responsible for all the content that gets posted on them?
I'm pretty sure there was a very high-profile case in Sydney about this, where a restaurateur sued TripAdvisor because of negative reviews left. That makes me feel a little uncomfortable. I think there should be moderation on these platforms, and I think that there is too much. I mean, you can always see it, can't you, when you go on a site and you can tell someone's, you know, had a wrong spoon served up the wrong way around, and it's incensed them beyond any rational repair, and, you know, you see the polite response from
them. Still gave them 3 stars, etc.
Yes, exactly. So I do think there does need to be some sort of moderation. It's impossible, of course, to fact-check people's truths or experiences when they go and experience a restaurant or something like this. But I also do think that restaurants need to live and die by their customer service, and there's a hell of a lot of bad service in the world.
Well, that's true. The trouble is, though, Vincent, I think it's fair to say that people, not so much with a restaurant, but when they go and seek a service, like a medical service or any other service you might seek, if you pay your money and they come round and do the job competently as you expected, then you just think, well, fine, that's how the world is supposed to work. Whereas it's the people who are upset or unsatisfied are the ones who are most likely to go online, which skews the reviews negative.
Yes.
So that's one issue. But I guess the fundamental question here is, should it really be possible to trash somebody's business anonymously?
I think you should be able to, as long as you can verify that you have been a customer of the organization or in the group, and if you are giving a fair, and if there's a policy that, you know, fair and accurate account, if the business comes back and questions it and you've got the sort of receipts, as it were, to prove it. And I've had two instances where I found this very effective. One is a management company of the building that I live in was an utter disaster. And so the way that we thought that we could get their attention, and it did work eventually, about issues going on, was that we had a coordinated response where we all essentially, you know, the word is doxing, but we had a right to do it because of serious issues going on. We absolutely destroyed them on Google reviews. Everything we said was fair and accurate, and their rating plummeted. And then that meant that other people were pouring in. And when we saw as well the reviews from other buildings that we were managing, we saw it wasn't just us, and that they were doing this across London, and that meant that we actually could get rid of them and had grounds to do it under the procedures. That was good. I've also had an experience with a rental car company where they sort of tried to pull a fast one in a scam. I posted a pretty negative review. I did have to, the company came back, and this was in Italy, the company came back and questioned it, and Google said we need to verify a few things, and TripAdvisor did the same, and I verified all of it. And what happened then was that there were other people who then did review, and when I then got into a battle via Expedia to get the money back that we needed, I could point to the other reviews and say, this isn't just me, this is a rogue operator, you need to strike them from your platform. So I'm a big proponent of, I think you should be able to do this. You know, as you say, most people have a fine experience, but if you do have something that is, you know, borderline negligent or criminal, then these sites are a godsend, really, because you can point to the other, you know, it's not just, you feel like, is it just me? They'll gaslight you that it is. But actually, if you see that it's happened and it's verified, it has to be verified, I would say. If you have a business, I think you have a right that, okay, well, show me the receipts of this person eating here or using the service or whatever. But yeah, I think it's great.
Final thought on this, though, Latika, do you think those reviews do actually make any difference to anything? And the reason I'm asking specifically is about one particular business I will not name directly. It is a legendary, and I use the word advisedly, hotel in Manchester. I can't really say I stayed there. I was once checked in there, took one look at it, and only twice in my life have I ever walked on a hotel that I had been checked into while travelling professionally. And I have stayed in places with bullet holes in the windows. But this place was just absolutely not. Every so often, I do still like to check in on its TripAdvisor page, which is best thought of really as a kind of work of collective performance art by an outraged public. It's genuinely very funny. It's got to a point where the reviews have become sort of competitive. Everyone's seen the one-star reviews before them and wants to go, okay, I've got to cap that. But my point being, this building is still absolutely inexplicably in business.
Unbelievable. I do think they make a difference. I certainly do use reviews. And where I find it very helpful is when I'm traveling alone. And if there is something in that that I think will help another woman who might be traveling alone for business or something, I do make a point of reviewing myself, although I don't like anonymity on the internet, but I must admit I do have a shadow Google reviewer name.
Is it Batika Lurk?
Not saying. You'll find it out one day, I'm sure. You can put your sleuthing to the test. So I do use them, but what I don't do is review everything I go to. I really only do review if I think it's exceptionally bad, and I try not to be that, oh, this was, you know, the one bad coffee I had in my life or something like that. Or if there is a tip for somebody else about how to avoid a scenario, which doesn't necessarily mean the entire experience was bad, but here's just a way you could get around it.
Well, if you are either of you ever going to Manchester, please do check with me first. Latika Burke and Vincent McAvaney, thank you both for joining us. Now to Milan and to Monocle's team at Salone del Mobile. Our design editor Nick Moniz spoke with Jonathan Olivares, an American industrial designer and the senior vice president of design at Knoll. At this year's edition of Milan Design Week, Knoll is releasing new colours for their four Bauhaus collection as well as their Tugend hat lounge chair. Nick began by asking Jonathan how he had changed Knoll's approach since joining.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of Knoll is that Knoll is actually an approach, and it's not a furniture company. It's an interiors company. And that already positions it, I don't want to say the work does itself, but it creates such a nice set of constraints that then it gives you all this freedom to work within, right? So Knoll is actually founded on one idea, and it's the idea that Ilyil Saarinen imparted on Florence Knoll, which was that if you work on a table, it must be done in the context of the room around it. And if you work on the room is done in the context of the building, and the building to the neighborhood, neighborhood to the city plan. So that's very different from the Gioponti, from the spoon to the city, because Gioponti means you design everything, from the spoon to the skyscraper. Ilyil Saarinen and Florence Knoll, totally different approach. It's when you design a table, like take the Saarinen table, it's really about removing legs so that the room becomes lighter and there's less things in the room. So that embodies the Knoll approach, right? And then the second kind of ingredient in the special sauce is that Knoll historically has worked with architects to do furniture. So from Mies van der Rohe to Ilyil Saarinen to Frank Gehry, the brand is really an architecture-centric brand. And so my role is really to work in that relational capacity from the furniture out to the room and also act as a kind of catalyst for the architectural zeitgeist.
How does that approach, I guess, thinking about, and we'll just use a simple example, when most people think about the design of the chair, they assume it's just like, well, I'm just going to think about how somebody sits on this. But really what you're saying is, how does somebody sit on this and how does that then sit within a room? Is that correct? Is that how you're looking at things?
Yeah, I look at furniture as sort of between the human body and the surrounding environment. So it's really an interiors scale project.
So then how does that translate to some of your projects? Is there a particular release or is there a particular work that really embodies this?
Totally. You know, one of the first pieces that we have produced under my tenure just debuted this week. So it's the Pillow Sofa by Willow Perron. And what makes it so quintessentially a Knoll project is that he had done it for one of his clients' interiors, who will remain nameless. So for those of you, for people, you know, if you don't know, Willow...
Yeah, give us the context.
So Willow Perron is a Los Angeles-based French-Canadian designer, grew up in the skate art direction world, is the kind of artistic director of Stussy Shops globally, is probably best known for his work for, you know, Rihanna, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Travis Scott, Drake, where he does production design for their concerts. And he also works a lot in the fashion industry, but he also does their houses. And so... in that context, Willow had developed this Pillow Sofa. And so I was just dropping by the studio in LA, like casually, like, what's up, Willow? And I see this thing and I'm like, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's a sofa I did for so-and-so's house in Houston. And yeah, it was really just meant for them to like crash out and smoke weed on. And it's like a, you know, Netflix and chill, like big old crash out sofa. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, you know, it's a stack of pillows, right? And when Florence Knoll briefed Eero Saarinen on the womb chair, her brief was a simple sentence. She was like, I want a basket of pillows that I can sit in. And, you know, Saarinen didn't exactly deliver on that. There's only two pillows, but the idea was there, right? And so when I look at the sofa in the studio, which was made by, you know, Willow and team did a good job with the local resources in LA and Mexico, and but the idea was there. right? It's a stack of pillows and very connected to this Florence Knoll idea of like pillows. So this is like another thing with Knoll, right? Like the furniture has to be a concept, an idea. So Eero Saarinen on his pedestal table, he would say, I want to clean up the slum of the legs, right? Like get rid of all that noise and just have one thing, one object, a total object, right? Frank Gehry's cross-check chair, like the man, you know, if you look at his Dennis Hopper lofts in Venice, the man was like really tied to skin as structure in his early work and in wood. And so the Gehry cross-check chair, like when Frank talks about it, he's like, look, it's, he would sort of say, everything is essential, right? And everything is one thing. So the legs and the seat are made of the same material. It's all skin. There's no bones, right? So this is where like there's an idea. And so I don't like, you know, it's not just like at Knoll, like, and just in my approach in general, like an idea grounds something. It's not just another sofa and I chose the leg and gave it a shape and, you know. So Willow's sofa, when I saw it, I was like, this is an idea. It's just a pillow and it's stacked. And pillows are really what we, that's the essence of a sofa, right? Like you just want to sit on a big pillow.
And I can say I was testing it out the other day and you kind of get sucked into it. It becomes this, it was almost like being on a bed. It's definitely a sofa, yeah. But it's almost like being on a bed on a big pillow.
No, I mean, in my living room, especially post-pandemic, we got a double chaise. So it's like a wide chaise. It's basically a bed in the middle of our living room. And it's like this island where the whole family and the dog and my daughter, we all kind of live on this island together. And yeah, Willow's sofa has that. We actually did it in two depths because the residential depth is so crash out and you want to be able to use this thing in a hospitality setting. So we did a shorter depth as well, which is also super comfortable, right? But so then the other thing about the design that was really great is that, so when you have a sofa of that scale, it can appear as if like an elephant just sat down in your living room. You know, it's like grotesque, big sofas. I think there's many on the market, but like big, big sofas, you know, like there's no form.
Completely dominate and they like can almost take over a room completely. Strip any sort of...
Completely.
Yeah,
and it's just
positive
a
atmosphere.
Massive monolith. And so the beauty of Willow's sofa is that it has levity. Because it's a stack of pillows, you don't read it as one big thing. You read it as smaller individual units. And the thin edge, the kind of blade edge along the ends of the pillows, gives it lightness. And so it is massive, but it appears light and thin edged and made of smaller parts. So you don't read it as this like elephant parking in your living room.
That was Jonathan Olivares of Knoll speaking to Monocle's design editor Nick Moniz. Finally on today's show, time for our weekly letter from, which this week is a letter from Rayleigh Beach in Thailand, visited recently by Monocle's Paige Reynolds.
At the dawn of a new millennia, a blockbuster film set against the backdrop of turquoise waters and soft white sands captured the cultural zeitgeist. Adapted for the screen from the 1996 Alex Garland novel by the same name, The Beach is a dark but seductive tale that follows a young, sweaty Leonardo DiCaprio on a chaotic path to seek out the kind of off-piste adventure many Thailand-bound travellers desire. After catching wind of a pristine, uninhabited island and getting his lucky paws on a map, DiCaprio's character is convinced he's found real-life paradise on Earth. Surprise, surprise, everything is not as it seems.
This time it's not like Cristo rotting out in the woods where no one can see! It's not like the four people that I saw killed today! This time, everyone has to watch Sal. Everyone has to see what it takes to keep our little paradise a secret.
Although almost 25 years have passed since its release, The Beach's idyllic scenes shot on the island of Koh Phi Phi Lee remain etched into my brain. So when the opportunity arose to take a trip to a destination just a long-tailed boat away, it was somewhat of a no-brainer.
Despite full awareness that harem pant-wearing gap year kids would line even the most secret of Thailand's beaches, I still thought I might just be able to find my own private nirvana, ideally with Leo in tow. And as I stepped onto the long, serene pier of Rayleigh East, I realised I might be half right. Located on a jagged peninsula in the southwestern province of Krabi, at first Rayleigh feels like any other Thai resort. With a selection of postcard-perfect bays, more crowds than you'd probably like, a range of low-to-high budget hotels, and a strip of borderline tacky restaurants and bars. Yet, after a few days in its rather warm embrace, I found this small, only accessible by boat enclave to have the kind of slow-drip charm that warrants a longer stay. The limestone cliffs, blanketed by dark green vegetation, feel somewhat more impressive here, as do the brave souls that scale their edges. Some climb to seek adrenaline, others seek the hidden lagoon that can be found somewhere off the East Rayleigh trailhead. Me, I prefer to watch in admiration from below, before making my daily visit to the thin, never-ending strip of sand that constitutes Phrenang Beach. Of course, there's monkeys too. After finding my way to my hotel's pool bar, just in time for a happy hour that finally reflected its namesake, I was calmly sipping on my third pina colada before cries of "Big Monkey!" shook me out of suspended animation. Lo and behold, across the other side of the water, an absolute beast of a macaque was swinging through the sunbeds and landed, of course, on top of my own. The mush of half-eaten tomatoes from a club sandwich I'd devoured hours before, too tantalising to pass up. I ran towards him and then stood very still. Could I take the monkey? I wasn't sure, but my relatively new iPhone was poking out from the towel he'd parked his long-tailed bottom on, and I wasn't letting my 4,000 unread emails go without a fight. Luckily, my indecision was cut short by the pool bar's top cocktail shaker, an ever-smiling man named Free, who brandished a slingshot and walked with calm purpose towards the furry alpha, causing him to skedaddle in a flash. There were calmer primates too. Along the banks of the shores, hidden at the top of its tall trees, were families of dusky leaf monkeys tending to their tufty orange young. But what really makes Rayleigh special are the evenings that unfold long after the gaggle of day trippers disappears over the horizon. A walk down Rayleigh's strip of actually quite excellent restaurants and bars after dark is like a trip back in time. The isolated nature of the place gives a kind of Groundhog Day feeling to each evening's proceedings. The more time I spend here, I'm not sure anyone knows what day it is, and I'm not sure they care. There's double-floored Thai restaurants where your steaming catch of the day and mango sticky rice gets delivered by an 80s-style pulley system. A notably outstanding family-run Indian restaurant, Kohinoor's, where I had a butter chicken I'll remember on my deathbed. Then there's Lek Sushi.
Hey, Lek!
An 8-seat countertop sushi joint run by, you guessed it, Lek. An uber-talented chef who honed his craft in Stockholm for almost 2 decades before returning to Rayleigh in search of a different pace of life. I talk his ear off while he torches another generous portion of his famous aburi salmon dragon roll. Life is good. And while you could call it a night there, you wouldn't want to. A quick stop off at the reggae-themed bamboo bar where Bob Marley plays on repeat weirdly does make you feel like everything's going to be all right. Or maybe you just want to head down to the almost deserted beach, now the madding crowds are far away, and stare into the clear night sky. There's so much about Rayleigh that means it could feel like any other Thai escape. But there's a bohemian magic in the air that makes me feel cut off from the world in a way I never have done before. A kind of offbeat je ne sais quoi that floods through me as I walk its streets. I haven't lost my mind or witnessed the untimely brutal deaths of any newfound friends, but something in me feels like Leo would be proud. From Rayleigh Beach for Monocle, I'm Paige Reynolds.
Thank you, Paige. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks also to our panellists today, Vincent McAvenny and Latika Burke, and to Guy Delaunay at the top of the show. And playing us out, Dickie Betts, guitarist with the Allman Brothers, who has died at the age of 80. Betts was beyond merely influential. He and Dwayne Allman contributed significantly to the invention of an entire genre, the heavily electrified country, which became known as Southern Rock. Betts also wrote many of the Allman Brothers' best-remembered hits and took lead vocals on this one, Ramblin' Man. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol, with editing assistance from Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.